If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is your typical radio ad while eating a Crunch Bar.
This is Automatic of Otto's Used Cars. This weekend only, we're having a whale! Bring the kids. See for yourself. It is huge. Gonna make a big splash. No other dealer can say they have a whale like this.
When things sound dull, turn up the fun with Crunch.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. It's time to get out your mince pies and mulled wine, because today we've got a special festive edition of our Everything You Wanted to Know series on the history of Christmas. I put your questions on everything from Boxing Day and carols to Santa's Red Coat to the historian and author George Goodwin, whose books include Christmas Traditions, A Celebration of Festive Lore, which was published by the British Library last year. So thanks very much for joining me. We've got lots of questions on the history of Christmas from our readers on social media who've sent in questions via Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. And we've also got some of the most searched for terms from search engines online. Let's start with a question from Lavie Marie, who was one of our Twitter followers, who asked, when did people start gathering together for Christmas parties?
Well, thank you very much indeed, Ellie. Well, with that one, that takes us straight in to the fact that the celebration for Christmas really stems from the fact that there has long been there has long been a celebration of the shortest day of the year, the midwinter celebration. It's the winter solstice. And it goes all the way back to Saturnalia, the Roman festival of Saturnalia, between the 17th and the 23rd of December. And of course, there were celebrations by the Saxons and the Vikings, and that's where Yule comes from. And as for Christmas, people sort of gathering for celebrations for Christmas, well, the secular part of Christmas has a lot to do with Saturnalia and Yule. And just to give you an idea of that, I've got a piece by the Roman writer Lucian in the role of the priest of Saturn, a sort of kind of lord of misrule. And this was written as early as the 2nd century AD. And he says, "During my week, the Sirius is barred, no business allowed. Drinking and being drunk, noise and games and dice, appointing of kings and feasting of slaves, singing naked, clapping of tremulous hands, an occasional ducking of corked faces in icy water. Such are the functions over which I preside." And of course, I mean, Saturn has come down to us in other ways as well. His old Father Time, less charmingly as the Grim Reaper. And of course, much more happily, he gives his name to Saturday. But as far as Yule is concerned, I mean, they had their own sort of traditions for feast. Well, of course, it was all about feasting and drinking. But they had, just as with Saturnalia, there was the decoration with greenery to give the idea of spring and the new year, and also of light, lots and lots of light. Again, the idea of the sort of the rebirth of the year. And they had a Yule log, which, unlike the sort of the modern chocolate Swiss roll version, was actually a proper log to burn all over the festival. So in terms of sort of answering that, the Christmas parties, it goes back a very, very long time ago.
So that leads us on to one of our next questions from Josephine Wong, which is, does Christmas have any pagan origins?
Well, on the face of it, it would look as if it certainly does, in the way that it kind of clicks together with, you know, our Christmas and, as we mentioned before, you know, the midwinter festival. And it would also sort of look as if, as soon as the Christians decided, or the church decided, that the Christmas day was definitely, the birth of Christ was definitely on the 25th of December, that all they did was, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to do a takeover of the pagan festival. Not at all. I mean, there was no decision actually on the day of Christ's birth until 354 was the day that the church decided that he was born on Christmas Day. And it's from that point, they fought very, very hard against the idea that the festival of Christmas, which was actually was called Christmas later on, but we'll come back to that, but the festival would not be linked with the pagan version. And this was the case right up to when Saint Augustine came over to England in the 579. And at that stage, he came with a sort of a mission from Pope Gregory the Great, which is, well, now that our festival is well established, let's bring in the heathen pagans by letting them have some of their sort of festival festivities. But at the same time, why don't we have a mass celebration, a proper religious celebration, by baptizing thousands, which is basically what happened. But the reason why the 25th of December was chosen originally was because the important date actually was the spring equinox, when the church believed that that was the date on which God created the world. So, of course, the creation of Jesus at the Annunciation, 25th of March, beginning of a new world, if you like. And, of course, the 25th of March is exactly 9 months before the 25th of December.
So now we've spoken a bit about the origins of Christmas, a lot of the questions that we had in were to do with traditions. So Siobhan O'Farrell on Facebook asked, are there any strange Christmas traditions that have been discontinued? And we also had another question from Emily M725, who said that she is studying Tudor Christmas at school. Can you tell us about some of the traditions from Tudor Christmas?
Well, taking the sort of the disappearing of traditions, well, and these would have been ones around during the Tudor period. Well, let's take mumming. Mumming was when people would arrive at your door, and they would be in all kinds of strange costumes. The key thing is that you wouldn't actually be able to tell who they were. And they would, mumming, obviously, they didn't talk to identify themselves. They would just make sort of, they would just sort of point in various directions, and you would have to guess who they were. Well, as you can imagine, this was an absolutely brilliant way of acting in a criminal fashion. So the fact that that one has gone is probably quite good.
Sounds a bit like trick-or-treating, that.
It is definitely like trick-or-treating. And the problem was that it was more likely to be trick than treating. And there was another one on a similar level, wassailing. This is an old tradition, again, going way, way back, where it was based on the idea of pouring wassail, sort of cider or beer, onto fruit trees. This was kind of the origin of it, to encourage their growth for the next year. But it developed into the creation of a drink which would be brought to your door, and there would be sort of the wassail song would accompany it. And again, this could be a bit dodgy, because people would sort of turn up at your door and say, well, have a drink. And we'll do a little song for you. And can we have some money, please? And of course, the drink could have been absolutely disgusting. So that's another one which has gone. But a rather sort of a nice one to deal with this potential criminal activity was the waits. Now, the waits were, if you like, the local village's security group, who would come around Christmas time, and they would play their musical instruments and they would sing to you. And that was a rather nicer way of doing it. Now, to come to the Tudor Christmas point, I'm going to sort of deal with the later period, the Elizabethan period, into that of James I. And we can identify the elements of Christmas which were enjoyed by sort of well-to-do families, because they were listed in a court Christmas mask at the court of James I and VI. And it was quite important, this, because it was called Christmas His Mask, and it was the first appearance of Father Christmas as a kind of personified figure. He hadn't really been given this sort of personality before. Anyway, he comes on stage, and it was a pretty wonderful stage, because it was put together by Inigo Jones, and Ben Jonson did the play. And Christmas His Mask listed the various elements of Christmas which were under threat from the Puritans. And these were misrule, where you had the sort of the world turned upside down, rather on the sort of on the lines that I said before with ancient Rome, when the slaves became the masters and the other way round. Carol, mince pie, gamble, post and pair, which was a card game, and New Year's gift. And then, of course, at the end, we have mumming, wassail, offering, which is giving an offering, and baby cake, which was a predecessor of our Christmas cake today. And the Puritans were basically against all celebration at this time because they regarded it as frivolous, and it was a throwback, as they saw it, as to the Catholicism of Rome, which they absolutely abhorred.
So, moving on from traditions to some of the most familiar aspects of Christmas. So, AgroBiodiverse asked, what is the earliest depiction that we know of the nativity scene?
Well, that was by St. Francis, no less, in Greccio in Lazio in 1223. But the nativity scene was also acted out. So you get the nativity scene and the first nativity play all in one go.
It's amazing that there's a record of that. Another what's the oldest question that we had was from Jessica Roberts on Facebook, who asked, what's the oldest known Christmas song or carol?
Well, the word carol, of course, is derived from the Greek choros, which is basically a circle dance with singing. Now, the first English carol is completely secular, and it's in Norman French. So please forgive my Norman French on this. It was entitled Seigneur, Ore Entendez à nous, and it dates all the way back to the early 13th century in the time of King John. And it exhorts everyone to keep open house and to be ready to ply a neighbour with drink until he nods his head and sleeps by day. And it's, as I said, it's written in Norman French, until the final Anglo-Saxon call of wassail, which I mentioned, and its response of drink ale. Now, the first religious carol, as before, that's down to Francis of Assisi, because he very much supported this form, but it was an unknown English Franciscan who wrote, "A child is born amongst man," and that was at some point before 1350. And of course, if we go back to the secular, I mean, one of the, and also to the previous question, I mean, one of the favourite sort of carols of medieval and, in fact, early modern England was one from 1521, the Boar's Head Carol, and with its great line, "The boar's head, as I understand, is the rarest dish in this land."
Well, that is the perfect link to my next set of questions, because as has already become apparent, one of the obsessions of Christmas is, of course, food and drink. And we've discussed this already, but a lot of people have asked quite specifically for us to talk about Christmas food. So Anna Lilyhook on Facebook said, "Can you please tell us about Christmas food through the ages?"
Well, yes. Well, I suppose that does lead in, because I mean, the boar's head, that was kind of top of the range in medieval England. It was an extremely laborious process, which I won't go into, but basically, you could either roast it, or if you were very, very rich, you would cook it in, well, you would pull the bits out, and you would marinate them in red wine, and then you would reform the head, and you would cook it all in red wine for hours and hours and hours. Actually, Lucy Worsley did a Tudor Christmas, and they recreated it for her, and she tried a piece, and she announced that she thought it was not very nice. She didn't like it, and I can quite understand why.
I was just going to say, have the main themes of Christmas food generally been that it's rich and it's luxurious?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, if you could afford it. I mean, if you were a poor peasant, I mean, it would just be a sort of a few scraps of meat and bacon that you would have saved up. But as time sort of progressed, I mean, as we moved into the sort of the 18th and the 19th century, dwelling on the English side of Christmas, the key dishes, of course, for Christmas and all great celebratory occasions were roast beef and plum pudding. And of course, this, or rather, I should say, plum porridge in its original creation. And this was, if you like, it could be sort of described as beef and more beef, because the porridge was made with meat stock. It's all actually a bit stomach churning, but I mean, I can give you the recipe if you'd like. Shall I give you?
Yes, please. A lot of people do search online if you type in historical Christmas for recipes. So I think a stomach churning beef based fruit porridge is exactly what we're after right now.
Well, I actually quite amusing. I read this out to the people at Ham House. They were the volunteers, and I read it out, and I said, "It really is pretty disgusting, isn't it?" And they said, no, we've tried it ourselves. We think it's absolutely delicious." But I think we'll let the listeners decide. Here we are. Take a leg and a shin of beef. Actually, I'll tell you, this recipe was from 1720. It was from Eliza Smith, the complete housewife or accomplished gentlewoman's companion. Start again. Take a leg and shin of beef to 10 gallons of water. Boil it very tender, and when the broth is strong, drain it out. Wipe the pot and put in the broth again. Slice 6-penny loaves thin, cutting off the top and bottom. Put some of the liquor to it, cover it up, and let it boil 1/4 hour, and then put it in your pot. Let it boil 1/4 hour, then in 5 pounds of currants. Let them boil a little. There's a lot of boiling here, as you can tell. And put in 5 pounds of raisins and 2 pounds of prunes, and let them boil till they swell. Then put in 3/4 ounce of mace, 1/2 ounce of cloves, 2 nutmegs, all of them beat fine, and mix it with a little liquor cold, and put them in a very little while. Then take off the pot and put in 3 pounds of sugar, a little salt, 1/4 of sack, 2 pints of sweet sherry, 1/4 of claret, and the juice of 2 or 3 lemons. There's no joy about it. You may thicken with sago instead of bread if you please. Pour them into earthen pans and keep them for use. What do you think, Ellie? Do you fancy that?
I don't think it's for me. I'm not really into the combination of meat juice and fruit. I'd like to keep those two separate, I think, really. Not on my Christmas table, I don't think.
Well, I don't think you're alone, because there was a Swiss visitor called César de Saussure who in 1720 wrote, "The soup is called Christmas porridge and is a dish few foreigners find to their taste. I must describe it to you, for it will amuse you. You must stew dried raisins, plums and spice in broth. Rich people add wine and others beer, and it is a great treat for English people, but I assure you, not for me." So
that is an amazing entry, isn't it? I think I'd be with him. I mean, a lot of listeners will have in their freezers at the moment the all-important turkey. So that is something that people have asked about. And Uncle Juma, which is a brilliant name, on Instagram asked, "Did the tradition of eating turkey originate in Britain or North America?"
Well, the Americans have one great advantage, of course, which is that turkeys come from North America. And, of course, the thought is that they must have had turkey at the original Thanksgiving in 1621. But actually, there is no proof that they had turkey. I mean, there were turkeys around. I think ducks and geese are mentioned, but there's no mention of turkey at all. So when Thanksgiving started was officially in 1863 by Abraham Lincoln. And it caught on during the late 19th century in America. And as time went on, Thanksgiving became more and more the thing. And turkey became more and more part of Thanksgiving. Now here, well, of course, we know that in Dickens' A Christmas Carol, that poor Bob Cratchit has got a very, very meagre goose to provide for his family. But Scrooge, when he's seen the light and decided that he's going to become nice Scrooge to Bob Cratchit, he takes along a large turkey dinner for the Cratchits. And turkey really came to the fore in the 1840s with a lot of our common current traditions, as no doubt we'll chat about in a bit. But it was a luxury food. I mean, it really didn't become the sort of the fallback position for Christmas, which I have not been allowed to have because my children sacked me from cooking Christmas lunch some time ago. My wife never cooked Christmas lunch, and my children took over. So we've had all kinds of things, but not turkey. So I rather miss turkey. But as far as England is concerned, it was really the 1950s and refrigeration, the ability to refrigerate these birds, which actually made turkey much more popular.
Yeah, doesn't go back as far as you think. And while we're talking about food, there is one more thing I wanted to ask you about. I was in Aldi this week buying mincemeat so I could make my own mince pies. And the guy behind the till said to me, "Oh, I'm from Poland." And I just never understood why you British want to have mincemeat inside a sweet pie. And then I'd realised that it's actually fruit. So I think mince pies are a strange food. What do we know about the history of them?
Well, let's go back to our Swiss friend, César de Saussure, on that one, because he talked about Christmas pies and he says everyone likes them. And he said they are made with chopped meat, currants, beef suet and other good things. You never taste these dishes except for 2 or 3 days before and after Christmas. And I cannot tell you the reason why. But he did like them. He did like the mince pie. And, oh, yes, they did. And they really, again, it was in the 19th century when, just as with the plum pudding, that over the century the meat disappeared and the lovely sweet elements, which were in there before, basically took over and became the complete mince pie. Now, of course, the mince pie, quite controversial. I mean, that, as we've seen, it was one of the things that the Puritans didn't like. And one reason they didn't like them was because of the shape. They were made in the shape of the manger. In Catholic England, and they had a representation of baby Jesus. Now, I'm not quite sure whether he appeared in pastry on top of the pie or he appeared in pastry in the pie. I think probably in the pie, maybe with a bit of pastry folded over so that, you know, you could see his head. But it was regarded as completely idolatrous by the Puritans. And, of course, lots of people have said, you know, did Oliver Cromwell, did he ban the mince pie? Well, he certainly didn't ban the mince pie. Though, of course, I mean, the Puritans did close down Christmas, particularly when it fell. This is after they'd taken over. I mean, Oliver Cromwell wasn't in Parliament. He was away with the army when in 1643... when the Scots joined the English in fighting Charles I, one of the parts that the Scots absolutely insisted on was that there should be a fast day on the last Wednesday of each month. Now, in 1647, the Wednesday, last Wednesday of the month, was actually Christmas Day. And they did sort of say, oh, right, you know, fasting today. People weren't even allowed to go to church. And so that's where the idea that they banned Christmas came from. But this whole idea of him banning the mince pie, no, it didn't happen.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
But in fact, the idea of gift giving, I mean, if we talk again about Christmas as a winter festival, we can again go back to ancient Rome. This time we'll have a quote from the first century and the poet Martial, who said, "I hate the crafty and mischievous arts of presents. i.e., you know, the idea you had to give gifts according to your station.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
So if we are moving on from the dining table to the Christmas tree and the presents underneath it, Matt Clement 97 asks, when did gift giving first become associated with Christmas?
Well, certainly, we've discovered, again, talking about the Puritans, that New Year's gift was around in late Tudor England. But in fact, the idea of gift giving, I mean, if we talk again about Christmas as a winter festival, we can again go back to ancient Rome. This time we'll have a quote from the first century and the poet Martial, who said, "I hate the crafty and mischievous arts of presents," i.e., you know, the idea you had to give gifts according to your station. So, you know, to keep in with people above you socially, you had to give them gifts, but obviously not too rich a gift, because then they would think, oh, you're pushing it a bit, you know, that doesn't really fit your station. And of course, you'd also expect to have gifts given to you. And you would give a sweetener to people who you believed were below you in station. And it chimes, I mean, with Jonathan Swift in the 18th century, he wrote, "I shall be undone here with Christmas boxes." Again, it was on the same principle of giving out gifts. And it was really mainly for adults. It was kind of like an adult festival. I mean, children really didn't come into this properly until the 19th century.
Of course, in the UK, we have Christmas Day, and then on the 26th of December, we have Boxing Day. Traditionally, I don't know, I spend it lying on the sofa watching films. But Sarah Soldnick asks, please explain Boxing Day to this American listener. What do we know about the history of this day?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of one's first thought, I mean, is it the time when half the nation comes out and fights the other half of the nation with boxing gloves that they've been given in their Christmas stockings? Fortunately not. I mean, it does refer back to this idea of Christmas boxes. Now, it's the present giving has sort of moved from New Year to this Boxing Day. And there is a sort of a predecessor in St. Stephen's Day, which is the 26th, where he was the first Christian martyr, when the country squire would expect his tenants to come along and enjoy some mince pies with him. And of course, they would expect a gift rather on the Roman tradition. He'd give them gifts, but he expected a very big gift from them. And that was the that was the approach. Now, of course, Americans, I'm very sorry to say, they don't actually have Boxing Day. It's Christmas Day, and then it's straight back to work for some. Though I think from talking to American friends, there is a sort of a growth in the European and British approach of taking a couple of weeks off over the period of Christmas and the New Year. But of course, I mean, our Boxing Day, it works rather well because Christmas Day, you've had, you know, the traditional Christmas Day, obviously not this year, but the traditional Christmas Day you have with the family. You're all sort of extremely jolly. You've had lots to eat and drink. And actually, the next day, you either want to collapse on the sofa, which is obviously the Ellie approach, or you want to get out and you want to, you know, go to some sporting occasion like a football match or rugby or whatever. And in fact, actually, traditionally, it was the day in which people would go get on their horses and go either riding or hunting or racing. So that's this sort of traditional day. But I mean, I think Boxing Day has, I really enjoy it, actually. I think it's quite a good sort of part of the 2 days of Christmas and Boxing Day.
Yeah, so do I. There's always good TV on as well. Moving on, if we're looking at what people were searching for online about the history of Christmas, we've got a lot of different just queries about different aspects of Christmas traditions and practices. So I wonder if I could fire a few of those at you. So first up, what is the history of Christmas trees?
Now they did come from Germany. Now that is agreed, but they didn't, as is thought, they didn't originate with Prince Albert. He definitely popularized them. There was a very, very large piece in the Illustrated London News, 1848, where massive, massive, great sort of feature with the royal family spending Christmas at Windsor with enormous Christmas trees and lots and lots and lots of presents. And this really sort of took off. As you can imagine, everybody wanted to be like the royal family, and Christmas trees became very, very fashionable. But he was not the first royal to introduce a Christmas tree. It was actually Queen Charlotte, George III's queen, who was the first one to bring the Christmas tree over from Germany.
That's a good amendment to, I think, what is a common misconception about Prince Albert bringing over the Christmas tree. And next up, we have, what's the history of Christmas stockings?
Well, Christmas stockings actually goes a long way back. That goes back to St. Nicholas, who St. Nicholas is the patron saint, if you like, of Christmas. He became the Dutch St. Nicholas. Sinterklaas is the Dutch for St. Nicholas. And of course, Sinterklaas became Santa Claus. And one of the stories about St. Nicholas is that there were three women who were very, very poor. They didn't have any money. They didn't have dowries to give to get married. And he actually gave them each a stocking of gold. And that's where the Christmas stocking comes from originally. And of course, this was taken up by the Dutch with the celebration of St. Nicholas's Day, and that actually was the 6th of December. But of course, it's for our Santa Claus, it moved to the 25th. And Santa Claus is actually very much an American invention.
Ah, how so?
Well, Santa Claus was created by Washington Irving, was the sort of the original seed for it, because around about the sort of 1809, 1810, New York was a new sort of metropolis, a growing metropolis, and the citizens, those prominent citizens, or some of them, as part of the New York Historical Society, wanted to create all kinds of traditions for this city. And I mean create. So Washington Irving rather ridiculed them by saying that St. Nicholas had had in his wagon, which normally was used to drop presents for children on the Dutch principle, because of course New York was New Amsterdam before, he pointed the way to these settlers to say, you know, this is the place, pointing down, this is the place where you should settle. So, you know, that's how New York came about, according to him. And of course, this rather caught on, this idea of this flying St. Nicholas. And through various sort of creations, we ended up with Santa Claus. And Santa Claus was definitely on the march, because it tied in with the early, the sort of the 1840s onwards present-giving tradition. And, of course, you have Santa Claus, this great present-giving figure. You have Father Christmas, who sort of gave a few little bits and pieces. And so basically was a takeover. But clever, clever Brits, we thought, right, okay, well, this figure may be Santa Claus, but we'll call him Father Christmas. So in fact, Father Christmas is Santa Claus. Santa Claus is Father Christmas. The two are one. So I think both sides are happy. And of course, this has happened around the world. I mean, Père Noël in France and the Weihnachtsmann in Germany, they're all Christmas figures. And in fact, actually, in Italy, they had a rather sad sort of Christmassy figure, La Befana, but she's been overtaken by Babbo Natale. So literally Daddy Christmas has become sort of the Italian favourite these days.
And La Befana, am I right in thinking she was some kind of witch?
Yes, she basically was, again, a little bit on the Sinterklaas approach, that good children would get something, but naughty children would get a whacking. And so, in fact, going back to the Dutch Sinterklaas, I mean, that was very much the case, that that good children were left sweets, and but bad children were left a broom for their parents to beat them with. But as you can imagine, I mean, in modern Holland, they tend to give all sweets. I mean, there's not a lot of beating going on, I'm delighted to say. But actually, I mean, I've been told by Dutch friends that even in the Netherlands, Christmas is becoming more and more prominent. But I mean, obviously, the two have been kept, because if you're a child, it's pretty good to have two lots of presents rather than one.
Traditions that we just now take for granted gradually build up layer by layer by layer until there's something almost unrecognisable from their first appearance. Another thing I wanted to ask about very quickly was Christmas crackers.
Oh, no, Christmas crackers, one of those wonderful inventions which happened through somebody has a kind of electric light bulb moment, if you like. In this case, it was a cracking log in a fire moment, because there was this chap called Tom Smith. I mean, some people have said it wasn't Tom Smith, it was somebody else, but I believe it was Tom Smith, who was a seller of wrapped sugar almonds. Now, he wanted to sell more and more of his wrapped sugar almonds. So he thought, well, can I come up with a gimmick to try and flog these things? And so he was sitting by his fire, and then it crackled. So he thought, aha, right, now, if I can get one of those newfangled little sort of strippy things which makes a crackling noise when you pull it, why don't I wrap my sugar almonds and include this little thing that you can pull? And it took off. It took off, and the sugar almonds soon... No, we don't want the sugar almonds. We want the cracker effect. And that's where the crackers come from.
See, I'd quite like some sugared almonds and a cracker. That'd be wonderful. So, a couple more questions. Many people will, of course, be familiar with the 12 days of Christmas. And that's something that a lot of people have searched for online. What's the history of the 12 days of Christmas?
Well, it was, again, we go back to the early church, who decided that the festival of Christmas, the religious festival of Christmas, as I said before, It would consist of 12 days. So that goes back to the Council of Tours of 567. And of course, counting down, the first day is Christmas. That's Christmas Day, I mean. The first day is Christmas Day. Christmas Eve is that. It's Christmas Eve. It's the eve of the festival of Christmas. And so people are going to ask me, so how about then the 12 days of Christmas? So where does that come from? Is there some great meaning to the 12 days of Christmas? Well, actually, I have to disappoint you, because all that stuff beginning with a partridge in a pear tree, that was just a children's game of memory and forfeits in a 1780 children's book called Mirth Without Mischief. That's where it comes from. There's no great significance to it at all. Now, there was a Catholic priest called Father Stockett, who did actually say that he'd found, going back to the mists of time, this is, I think, in the 1970s, the mists of time, there was a meaning to the partridge and the pear tree, etc., etc., and he'd found it in some old Irish Catholic texts. And when he was pressed on it to try and produce them, he said they'd actually been washed away in a flood in a church crypt. So I think that's very good. The dog has eaten my homework on that one. I'm afraid we have to go back to Mirth Without Mischief. And I hope that doesn't insult too many and hurt too many of your listeners. But I'm afraid that, there's no meaning to it at all.
Fancy a cuppa now. That's their Twitter handle, spectacular Twitter handle, asked a question which brought in two elements, really, partly Prince Albert, who we've covered, but also partly Charles Dickens. But I wanted to just kind of broaden this out to ask about the way in which our modern Christmas is really shaped by the Victorian era.
Very good question. Well, it is completely and utterly shaped by the Victorian era. And we have to... let's sort of start off with a trio of novelists who basically held each other in the greatest regard. I mean, the first of these was Sir Walter Scott, and he has a few references to Christmas in Marmion, talking about, you know, the traditional Christmas. Washington Irving, he comes up again. He was a great fan of Sir Walter Scott. He went to visit Sir Walter Scott, and because he was over here just after the Napoleonic Wars, Washington Irving, and he recreated a traditional English Christmas. He went to go and stay in various country houses, and he recreated, and in fact, some ways created a Christmas that was traditional. And a great fan of his was Charles Dickens. Now, Irving wrote Christmas at somewhere called Bracebridge Hall. And Dickens wrote to Irving and he said how much he admired him and he wanted to be with him on the last coach of Christmas Eve to arrive at Bracebridge Hall. And he echoed him in creating a rural Christmas in the Pickwick Papers in Christmas at Dingley Dell. But he also created the urban Christmas, a time of great family sort of gathering and a time when children were very much included. They were having Christmas presents and... So that was actually he first did that in the mid-1830s in one of the sketches by Boz, A Christmas Dinner. And of course, most famously, in A Christmas Carol. And, he really was somebody who helped get across the idea of a family Christmas, but in a sense he was riding a tide there, because again with Prince Albert And in America, it was becoming very, very popular. It changed. I mean, Christmas became then a great family occasion and a time really to include children. And in fact, Washington Irving, back in his original creation, he very much included Christmas presents for children as well.
One of the big myths of Christmas, and whether it is true or not, this is something that always comes up when we talk about history of Christmas, and people always ask it. So Wendy Arl did the honours this time on Facebook and asked, is it true that Father Christmas's outfit used to be green and then it was changed to red because red was Coca-Cola's colour?
Now, it was quite common for Father Christmas to be green. He could also be purple. He could be brown. He could be blue. He could be all sorts of colours. Now, when did he become red? Well, this is the BBC, and this is a reverse advert, because it wasn't Coca-Cola at all. It was the person who went furthest in creating the sort of depiction of Santa Claus, Father Christmas, as we know today, a great artist called Thomas Nast, and that was way back in the 1870s. But the Father Christmas in the sort of complete red suit with the fur trimmings and the proper hat, that was first drawn by an Australian artist, though he was based in New York, called Frank Nankivell. And he did that. The first I've been able to see in a Christmas edition of a magazine called Puck was 1902. Now, Coca-Cola first took on board the red Father Christmas in their Christmas advertising. That was actually not till 1931. But I have to say, I mean, you know, fantastic art by the two sort of most famous artists, Haddon Sundblom and then Norman Rockwell, really sort of, if you like, sort of grabbed the brand. So I'm sorry to Coca-Cola to kind of take the brand recognition away, but you've done such a good job that people will be asking this question for a very long time to come.
And finally, as somebody who's written a book on the history of Christmas and festive traditions, I did just want to throw in one question of my own, which is, what's your own personal favourite historical Christmas tradition?
My favourite historical Christmas tradition. Now, that's actually a very good question, because, of course, there are so many of them. I actually have to say that I am a real sucker for a Christmas carol. Not so much a sucker as my son, who became a kind of Christmas carol junkie. I mean, he would go from one carol service to another. But I do actually like a Christmas carol, and I think that that's a very nice note to... gosh, that's a poor pun. A very nice note to end on.
That was George Goodwin. His book, Christmas Traditions, A Celebration of Festive Lore, is on sale now, published by the British Library. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us tomorrow to hear Francis Young on Christmas Ghost Stories.